2011, and we're going to continue on with the seminar, Prabhupada Living Bhagavatam, and the topic is prasadam. But before I begin, I'd like to welcome Mother Narataki, Hare Krishna. Did you join in Melbourne? Oh, in Sydney. All right. But you were down here a long time, right? In the early days. So when were you in Melbourne? Okay. Long time. okay. So yesterday we heard a little bit about how to entertain guests. Now we'll hear a little bit about how not to entertain guests. It's not that when Prabhupada was with us, everything was done perfectly, far from it. All the same mistakes, blunders, and foolish behavior that we see nowadays was also exhibited in those days. And the only difference is, of course, that Prabhupada was there sometimes to personally correct us, which was our good fortune. So the first example was in December of 1976. Prabhupada had just gone down to Hyderabad, and on the outskirts of Hyderabad, about 1 hour out, there was a 560-acre farm that had been donated to ISKCON. So when Prabhupada set off, we'd had 3 months in Vrindavan, September, October, November. We drove to Delhi on the 1st of December, and as Prabhupada got into the car, he said to nobody in particular, "Now we are starting a new phase of this movement." Jagadish Prabhu was Prabhupada's secretary at that time, so naturally he wondered what that was, because Prabhupada didn't say anything more. So he asked Srila Prabhupada, "What would that be, Srila Prabhupada?" And Prabhupada replied, "Varnashram." So he had a lot of hopes that we could do something with this property. He had a plan. He was going to attract the local people, villagers that were already farmers, with prasadam and kirtan. And then gradually, as they got purified, he would invite them to live on our land. And his plan was to have small clusters of houses all around the property. So like about a dozen different little villages, if you like. And each place would be centered around a small temple of Lakshmi Narayan, Radha Krishna, Venkateshwar, etc. Any Vishnu Murti. And the villagers would be given 2 or 3 acres of land that they could use as their own. They could grow their crops. They could come to a morning program centered around the temple in the morning, go out, do their work, come back in the evening, again gather at the temple, chant Hare Krishna, and be happy. And that was the whole program. Varnashram, as Prabhupada envisioned it, was not complex. But of course the basis of that is economic, that if you can get your own food, if you can build your own houses, if you can make your own cloth, and if you can make your own medicine, then you're self-sufficient. So Prabhupada used to talk about self-sufficiency. Those are the four items. And here in Hyderabad, that was his hope, that we would be able to actually attract these local villagers to come and live with us, and then we would simply train them to be devotees. No change in occupation, they would continue as they're doing, but a change of heart. Yeah. So this place was in just an hour and a half out of Hyderabad, at a place called Medchal. And as soon as we got there and got settled in, Prabhupada inaugurated a new program. Mahamsa Swami at that time was in charge. And there was also visiting Hansa Dutta, Swami at that time, he had a couple of buses and about 30 German brahmacharis. So they were touring all over the country. They came down. And he had also had some involvement with the development of the farm. We'd actually been doing something there for about a year before the legalities were finally sorted out. So Hansa Dutra had sent some money from Germany, so he had a little bit of a stake in the management there. And the other devotee that was involved as a manager was Tejas Prabhu. Tejas had been the temple president in Delhi for about 4 years. But previous to joining ISKCON, he had been in the American Peace Corps. So in America, of course, in the 60s and 70s, they were fighting the Vietnam War. And apparently there was an alternative that instead of joining the War Corps, you could join the Peace Corps. And the Peace Corps meant you did 2 years in some country or another, so-called Third World, help educate the locals. I think that was the mentality. So Tejas was sent in the Peace Corps to South India, and for 2 years he was helping to develop systems of crop rotation and teaching villagers how to best utilize the land. So he had a lot of expertise in that area, and plus he was a very intelligent man, still is. He lives in Udupi right nowadays. So he learnt the local language, so he could speak Telugu. When he came to Delhi as a devotee, he learnt Hindi, so he was well equipped. So he was invited by Srila Prabhupada to come down and get involved with the Hyderabad project as well. So the first thing that Prabhupada told the devotees was to go out and preach. Yeah. when we got out to the farm, there were a few local brahmacharis. There were the German brahmacharis. And of course there was not much going on. Prabhupada would receive his Guru Puja after his walk, and sometimes he was giving a short Bhagavatam class, and then the rest of the day he was in his room. Of course the quarters at that time were very crude. They'd actually built a small house for Srila Prabhupada, but it wasn't quite ready when we moved on to the farm, so we had to wait for a few days. And in the meantime there was a little strip of rooms, yeah, three or four rooms in a line, very simple, single brick walls, tin roof, and a very kind of crude bathing facility there. So Prabhupada was staying in one of those rooms for a few days, and he saw the brahmacharis were all just hanging around, not doing anything. So he ordered the managers, you send them out and to preach. So he had them going out in the daytime doing Harinam, and they would go to the local villages, they would do Harinam, and then advertise that we are having a Pandal program on our land every evening at 7 o'clock or 7:30. So that way then the first program was held I think on the 8th of December, and it actually went quite well. About 150 villagers turned up with their wives and a lot of children. There was a nice kirtan. The devotees built like a small stage and a very crude shamayana over the top of that, and they had kirtan. Prabhupada told them, you cook up some nice prasadam, and then that's the program, chanting and prasadam, nothing more. They're villagers, they won't understand too much philosophy, but you just feed them and, you know, deal with them nicely, attract them to the chanting, they'll become devotees. So the first program was not bad, it was quite good actually. But then the next day, on the 9th, then it was an utter disaster. So, this is December the 9th, 1976, in Hyderabad, or at the Hyderabad farm. As it turned out, the Pandal program didn't go too well. Only about half the number of people came, and the kirtan was poor and unorganized, with little participation. Villagers were left to aimlessly mill around, and none of our men seemed to be taking much interest in them. Tejas gave a short talk in Telugu, and then afterwards the prasadam was served. Srila Prabhupada didn't go out, he stayed in his room, leaving it to his leaders to conduct the program, seemingly unaware of the situation outside. Yet, at about 8:30 p.m., he rang his bell. I went into his room, and he asked me to bring him a little of the prasadam that was being served to the guests. I thought it was a little unusual. Because of his delicate digestion, he never eats the general prasadam, preferring only that which is cooked by his own staff. Nor does he eat much so late in the evening. So I sent one of the devotees out to get some prasadam, and then I placed it on Prabhupada's desk. So he brought it back on a leaf plate, and I placed that on Prabhupada's desk. It was just a large coagulated lump of rice plonked onto a dusty leaf plate, and it tasted as bad as it looked. As soon as it touched Prabhupada's lips, he spat it out. "This is poison," he said, and angrily demanded to know who had cooked it. I thought I'd better go out and find out for myself what was going on. After a few minutes looking around, I returned and I gave my report. The kirtan had finished, and large numbers of our guests were standing around looking bored and ignored, and no one would touch the prasadam. In fact, most had thrown it down on the ground. It was so inedible that I saw even the dogs were going up, sniffing it and walking away, refusing to eat it. I went round the side of the goshala to the open-air kitchen. A couple of pits with raised mud sides blazed with ignited wood as deep metal woks balanced on the top. I was shocked as I recognized the cook. He was a sweeper that was employed for cleaning the grounds and toilets in the mornings. Now he stood with a beady in his mouth, enough smoke curling from his mouth that it matched that which was curling up from the fires that he was tending. One of the devotees told me that he had seen the fellow scoop off the top layer of rice, which was well cooked, and he had put it aside for himself and his family. Then he sent a batch of the inedible clag to be offered to the deities. When I asked who was responsible for the arrangements, everyone said Mahamsa was the only one that knows. And when I asked where Mahamsa was, nobody seemed to know. Prabhupada was absolutely furious. He called in Jagadish, who was the secretary, Hansaduta and Tejas, and demanded to know who was responsible for the bad program. He shouted at them, "The poison which is not fit for dogs to eat, we are giving to human beings. We are trying to attract them to come and live here with us, but once coming, they will never come again. They are coming for the tongue, not for hearing your sweet voice. If they want to hear a sweet voice, they can listen to some woman, so your kirtan will not attract them. They are coming for the prasadam, and you are giving them poison cooked by a sweeper. Materially, it is impossible to eat, and spiritually, it has no value." He berated them for about half an hour. Chutigraja, the farm manager, was also called. Prabhupada demanded to know why the prasadam was so poor, simply inedible rice. Chutigraja apologized, saying that he didn't have enough money for proper prasadam. Prabhupada then asked why didn't he come to Jagadish, and then he demanded to know from Jagadish why he didn't supply the money. Jagadish, along with the others, was silent. They all hung their heads with little to say. No one seemed to take responsibility, all saying that everything seems to depend on Mahamsa's presence, and without him, it was difficult to get anyone to do anything. Prabhupada was extremely annoyed with Mahamsa because he had still not returned from Hyderabad, and by now it was 10 o'clock. "When I was at the temple, they said that he was at the farm. Now I'm at the farm, they say, oh, he's at the temple. And when I ask why these things are going on, nobody but Mahamsa knows." Finally, after letting them all know that he held all of them responsible, he sent everyone out and took rest. Mahamsa eventually arrived at around 11 p.m. and Prabhupada said that he would see him in the morning. So the next morning was December the 10th. You have to get me a bigger table, right? Tomorrow, not now, tomorrow. So December the 10th was the disappearance day of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Prabhupada, and we observed a half day fast. Early in the morning at 6 a.m, Prabhupada called in Mahamsa along with other senior men. By this time it cooled off, at least externally. He preached to them that things must be organized in a proper fashion, otherwise everything would be a failure. He told them, "I am not prepared to invest anything here if things continue as they are. You must make immediate plans for irrigation and vegetable and sugarcane crops." But that was an issue also. That Prabhupada had given Mahamsa about 60,000 rupees during the year for growing crops. And he had, you know, previously inspected the land in 1975 and it needed irrigation. So he gave him enough money so that they could do that and then grow. And the idea was that they would grow crops, sell them, or at least keep enough for themselves and then sell the excess and then put that money back into growing more crops. So when Prabhupada arrived there, no crops were growing, no irrigation channels had been made, and no money was left. So, and Mahamsa was asking for another loan. So Prabhupada was not very happy with that. So then he took up last night's disaster and he told him, "No one will come here because we are allowing a sweeper to cook." He was very grave. "It has shocked my heart that you can allow a sweeper to cook and then offer such things to Krishna. We say that you must be second initiated, but you have allowed a sweeper to cook. This means that after 7 years you are still a malecha, yavana. Your consciousness has not changed. We are saying Radhikara Pakaana Vivijabhyanjana Paramaranande Krishna Korana Bhojana. Radhikarana Gopi friends are personally cooking and making such nice arrangements for giving very palatable foodstuffs simply for pleasing Krishna. And you are offering things cooked by a sweeper." Mahamsa was apologetic. He told Srila Prabhupada that he was unable to find any devotee that could do the cooking, and thus he had hired the sweeper. In fact, Mahamsa was largely unaware of who was cooking. He had gone off to the city to finalize the legal documents for the formation of the new trust before Prabhupada departs, and he had left Achyuta Grudger at the farm to organize. Achyuta Grudger had foolishly engaged the hired sweeper. But Mahamsa was overall in charge, and Prabhupada held him responsible. Prabhupada told him previously, that he is not all-pervasive like Krishna. Yet if he is not personally present, nothing seems to go on properly. So that was a criticism that Prabhupada told Mahamsa. That he realized that, you know, Mahamsa was the only one that was giving instructions. And unless he gave instructions, nothing happened. So Prabhupada criticized him, "You are not all pervasive like Krishna." In other words, you can't know everything that's going on, but if you're not personally there, nothing goes on. In other words, delegate. Yeah? Train people up to do the necessary activities. So again, he is neither competent to manage everything himself, nor is he competent to train others to manage things properly. With displays like yesterday's, Prabhupada is becoming increasingly dissatisfied. Similarly, both Hansaduta and Tejas were present at the lethargic program, but they also did not check the details of the arrangements. Prabhupada told the small assembly, "You are all dead men," he said. "Dead men cannot preach. Whatever preaching there is will all be finished. The first principle of preaching is utsahan, enthusiasm. And without this enthusiasm, nothing will go on." So that was it. Prabhupada was kind of quite measured. He wasn't shouting anymore. But still, he was very angry about the whole thing. So then we had a program in the daytime, which actually went quite well. It was Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's disappearance festival, and I believe Prabhupada initiated some men. He also gave a wonderful talk on the first four verses of his poem, Adore, Adore Ye All the Happy Day, Blessed Than Heaven, Sweeter Than May. Somebody had found that in a BTG there at the farm and given it to him, so Prabhupada recalled how he first met Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and then he explained the meaning of these the first four verses from his poem. So it was very, very wonderful. And then the devotees cooked actually a good feast to celebrate the occasion. Prabhupada went out and personally tried every preparation, and it was nice. So then there was the question of the evening meeting again, and Prabhupada was again sitting in his room as the devotees and children chanted Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, and Govinda Jaya Jaya, Gopala Jaya Jaya, with great energy and enthusiasm. Prabhupada met with Jagadish Prabhu in his house, so we could hear. Some of the villagers had come, and one of the devotees had got them all chanting. All the kids were running around, you know, singing Govinda Jaya Jaya, Gopala Jaya Jaya, and Hare Krishna. They were all in ecstasy. And Prabhupada could hear it all from his room, so he was smiling. So he emphasized again and again the need to provide very nice, palatable prasadam. So at this point he just had Jagadish Prabhu in his room. So he told us that this was the crux of his plan to spread Krishna consciousness throughout the area. We shall spend for that. Why miserly? There is no need of miserly. You are going to earn money by agricultural produce. So how will that money be utilized? It will be utilized for Krishna's purpose. By prasadam, by chanting, by drama. Somehow or another, bring them. That is our mission. Congregational chanting. Always a festival. And we shall spend for that. Immediately you arrange. If there is any scarcity of money, I shall pay. But somehow or another, bring them. Tomorrow I want to see at least 500 men. I came here to see that, not to sit down in a room peacefully. Referring to the upcoming Gita Pratishthan meeting in Wardha, he said, there we shall also inform that meeting that we want to propagate this Krishna consciousness movement town to town, village to village, by attracting them with musical demonstration of Sankirtan, dramatic play, movie, and prasadam. Somehow or another, they should come to the temple, to the pandal, and congregationally chant Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, hear the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam. And for this purpose, whatever expenditure is required, that you shall collect and spend. This is the scheme of the Hare Krishna movement. So there you go. That's the whole thing. Chanting, dancing, prasadam. No other business. And some movie, Krishna consciousness, or some drama, just to attract people's minds. You get them chanting, you feed them prasadam, they become devotees. That's it. That's all we're doing. Yeah, we have no other purpose. Now this Gita Pratishthan meeting that's mentioned there, when we left Hyderabad, we went by train up to Wardha, which is kind of in the dead center of India, more or less, still in Maharashtra. But Wardha was the place where the Congress political party first began, the first Indian political party. Gandhi had his Save Ashram just nearby, the Gandhi Ashram. The village was renamed as Savagram. And then there was Vinoba Bhave. He had his place also in the immediate area. So Bhave had requested some of the leading Gandhians, Ramkrishna Bajaj. He was the owner of the Bajaj electrical company, Bajaj scooters, motorcycles, fans, etc. And Sriman Narayan, who was he had been the first governor of Gujarat when that was formed in the 1960s. He was a well-known author, and they were all contemporaries, or they had all been brought up in that Gandhian mode. So they were concerned that India was going to hell, All the young people were being divorced from their spiritual culture. The schools were secular. Nothing was being taught on Bhagavad Gita and the Shastra. So they were very concerned. And as a result, Bhave had requested them, you hold this Gita Pratishthan, which was a meeting where they invited leaders from many different spiritual groups to get together for 2 days and then discuss how they could popularize the Bhagavad Gita again in India. So Prabhupada, of course, was the leading preacher of Bhagavad Gita in the world. So he had been invited. The organizers had very great respect for him. And so Prabhupada agreed to go there. And we were going to go there from Hyderabad, which we did, but that's another story. Anyway, so go on there then. So Prabhupada was saying, this is the scheme of the Hare Krishna movement. Very simple. Chant, dance, and eat. No other business. For those that were educated, he recommended distribution of literature and scholarly presentations in schools, colleges, libraries, and universities. Taking assurance from Jagadish that he had understood, he repeated his main point. To attract them to really nice prasadam, palatable food, we shall spend. Where is the difficulty? We shall make a contribution from rich persons. Take a contribution from rich persons. We shall earn ourselves and spend it to give them very nice prasadam. As people come to join us, he said, they could be engaged in growing their own food and making their own houses and making their own cloth. As soon as they understand, they will be glad to do it. And they will stop all this nonsense, illicit sex and meat eating. Then their life will be purified. And they'll make more and more advancement on this path. So that is perfection, and this is our mission. He pointed out that people travel miles to get a good meal from a restaurant or a hotel. And we cannot give nice Krishna prasadam? Why? Why you cannot give? You arrange like that. First class. Simply for eating they will come. Immediately you do it. When Jagadish asked what sort of prasadam we should give, Prabhupada told him, you give them nice prasadam by which they are attracted. It doesn't matter. Khichdi, puri, kachori, laddu, whatever they are attracted, we must give. But Krishna prasadam, don't waste. You give them nice palatable food stuff. You give one finest kachori, one nice samosa, two puris. Oh, they will be very glad. So you make very, very nice prasadam. He was still agitated by last night's fiasco. What is this rubbish? The dog cannot eat even. They have done a great mistake. All rascals. I am very angry. I say that if you have got no money, I will spend. I will give you money. Why you should make such 10th class and no food at all? It is to be thrown away. Simply a waste of grains and energy. You engage a nice professional cook and prepare nice foodstuffs. I shall spend for that if you have no money. Gentlemen who are coming immediately should be offered some prasadam. Please come here. Take puri, kachori, samosa. The poor arrangements for the pandal, he said, were not the only incident of bad management. Prabhupada referred to a disturbing incident several days ago when Dr. Singha Ghosh had come to massage him. So Dr. Singha Ghosh, he was a physiotherapist, very expert. He actually used to treat the Nehru family, Indira Gandhi and all her clan. So he was a top doctor. He had a place at Kodaikanal. Who's from South India? Anybody? Yes, you know Kodaikanal. Yeah, everybody knows. Hill Station. And he had a very nice place there. Many Westerners would come, all very big people in India, rich people, they would come and get treated by him. And he was actually very expert. And he had heard about the devotees. He came to see Srila Prabhupada in Hyderabad in August when Prabhupada had opened the temple there. And he promised that he would come back and he would personally treat Srila Prabhupada. So he did actually keep his promise, despite the fact that he was super busy. For 5 days, He was coming out to the farm every day from Hyderabad, an hour and a half there, an hour and a half back, and he would treat Srila Prabhupada for about an hour and a half to 2 hours by massaging him with a special vibrating massage technique that he had developed. It was, when I first saw it, I thought it was a bluff, actually, I have to confess. He was a very energetic man. He was probably already in his late 50s at that point, but he had a lot of energy. And when he treated Srila Prabhupada, I was watching, he gave Prabhupada the massage. And when he massaged Prabhupada, he would vibrate his hands up and down. And I think he said he was vibrating at like 40 vibrations a second or something. I don't know how he counted it, but anyway, he was vibrating. And he was going up and down, and he put he had me make hot towels, and then he would put the hot towels on Prabhupada's joints. Every day Prabhupada was very, very happy with what he was doing. And of course, he was coming in the morning, and then by the time we finished, it was about noontime. And he had missed his breakfast in order to come out. But then when, Prabhupada suggested you have some prasadam, and he called for the devotees, there was no prasadam. So he had to do without. So Prabhupada was very disturbed by that this gentleman had come, done so much service, and he couldn't even get any prasadam. The doctor came. He comes out of love, but there is no prasadam. What is this? The doctor comes, but we cannot supply him prasadam at 12 o'clock. Prabhupada reiterated the standard that he had told his managers in Vrindavan to maintain. Prasadam, as soon as they want, they must feed some prasadam according to the position of the person. We shall spend for that. I am not hesitating to spend money, so why the arrangement is lacking? Immediately you arrange for this and invite them. Don't make it childish. I want to see tomorrow many thousands of people. If you cannot make attractive, then why will they come? Then it is a failure. You make it attractive. Whatever money is required, I shall pay. Simply theory will not help. Make such prasadam as people will come and be mad after it. He asked for his other leaders who were still engaged in the kirtan, asking Jagadish whether he had written everything down so that he could repeat it to the others. Jagadish assured him that he had recorded it on tape, and then he went off to bring the other leaders in. The chanting stopped, and Mahamsa Swami entered with several other men. Prabhupada spoke with him frankly and firmly, again stressing the same points. He asked Mahamsa if he was satisfied with the turnout this evening. Mahamsa admitted that he was not. Then, Prabhupada asked him pointedly. Mahamsa again excused the poor arrangements. Well, no, the people also, there was no advertisement today that there would be a program. So whatever it is required, you do it, Prabhupada told them. You give them very, very first class prasadam. They will come for the tongue. Mahamsa nodded in agreement. He told Srila Prabhupada that the local villagers like their food very spicy. Whatever they like, I do not know what they like, Prabhupada replied, but you prepare and they should come and eat. Whatever it may be, whatever they like, the villagers, then you can prepare. If you have no money, I shall pay the money, but you attract them. They will come here to eat. Oh, very nice thing. So that is wanted. He told us that the whole beginning of his creation of ISKCON was on the basis of prasadam. So the other night we read that when Prabhupada arrived at New Vrindavan, Kirtananda was there, and he said, that was my program from the very beginning. Eat, chant, and go home. No talk. You just come here, you chant Hare Krishna, you eat prasadam, and you go home. Then after some time, when they become purified, then you can give some philosophy. I made this movement successful simply by the love feast. They didn't come to hear Hare Krishna. They came for the love feast. From the very beginning, when I was at 26 Second Avenue, every Sunday I was giving nice foodstuffs, at least 200 men. That was Prabhupada's beginning of the movement. He was personally cooking the Sunday feast. and giving the lecture and chanting, everything himself at 70 years old. And he had 200 people coming for his Sunday feasts, and he was cooking, you know, half a dozen preparations and, you know, distributing that, and everybody loved it. So he relaxed a bit and he reminisced about his early followers. Daily, at least more than 15 or 20. And I was cooking myself. So that is the beginning of my movement. The chapatis with Kirtananda. First of all, he was taking one or two, then 12. As we all laughed, and Prabhupada's slight frame shook with mirth, he recalled a story that he was especially fond of. There was another boy, Stridish, 22 chapatis. Stridish, can I give you? Yes. I gave him 4. Finished. Stridish, can I give you? Yes. Prabhupada laughed in fond remembrance. Very nice boy. He was eating 22. One day there was no money, so he immediately went and then came after some time with some money. And where did you go? The shoe booth. So he had polished the shoes and then he had brought some money. Laughing again, he told us that this was how his movement had developed. Repeatedly, he told Mahamsa that providing palatable prasadam was the primary concern. Telling him to hire a first-class cook and assuring him of sufficient money, he said, "So long I am living, I shall go on paying. You don't be miserly. Bring devotees for eating, and then chanting, then cinema, then lecture, and in this way you have to develop. Not that people will come. Oh, Hare Krishna mantra is there. Let's go away." They will not come. What do they know about Hare Krishna? They will come. Oh, it is nice. Good prasadam distributed. Mahamsa, as compliant as ever, ventured to mention last night's failure, somehow not quite grasping the reality. Well, some people I know, they said that yesterday the prasadam wasn't nice and there was... This is after Prabhupada had already chastised him like anything. Prabhupada's blunt but controlled retort cut him off. "Not nice. It was not eatable even by the dogs." "But you are less than dogs if you prepare such things. I was surprised. You allowed a sweeper to cook. I was surprised. We have distribution of prasadam, not dog's food. Such rascals are there. You do not know. I do not wish to discuss any more on this point. You have murdered the whole thing in 2 days. Now, if possible, you bring them first-class prasadam. Very palatable. Foodstuffs means that even if I have no appetite, I'll eat. That is food. Not that even when he has an appetite he'll forget. That is not food." He told him to grow crops like sugarcane and rice to make money for the programs. Mahamsa has spent a lot of money so far, but for no return. And Prabhupada told him to manage like a businessman. He invests money. He gets a return. And then you spend it for Krishna. That is wanted. There is no question of becoming a miser. I never did it. When I have got that farthing, I wanted to spend it. Immediately spend. Oh, and what have I made with this BBT? Immediately, 50% for printing and 50% for spreading this. Easing off a bit, Prabhupada told him, "So, whatever is done is done. Now you do it very nicely. I want to see at least 1,000 men coming from the villages." So they did keep the program going as long as Prabhupada was there. And then as soon as we left, the whole thing collapsed. Yeah. In early January, Prabhupada was back in Bombay. Then Mahamsa came and he was complaining about Hansaduta and Tejas. Then Hansaduta came and he was complaining about Mahamsa. And the end result was that the whole program had immediately finished as soon as Prabhupada left. So after so much emphasis, so much, you know, stressing on the point, still they couldn't arrange it. So it was a failure, unfortunately. So don't think that, you know, everything happened, you know, just because Prabhupada said something that then, you know, everything was perfectly arranged. It wasn't. There were many things that Prabhupada wanted to do, but somehow or another they weren't done because the devotees weren't competent, you know, they were distracted or whatever it was. But it wasn't, you know, that everything just happened like magic. Prabhupada had to work very, very hard and had to continuously train everybody over years and years. The same things again and again and again. That was one thing that impressed me when I first joined Prabhupada's party. That, you know, I made mistakes. I was only in the movement about 3.5 years, just less than 4 years at that time. And I really didn't know anything. And so Prabhupada, you know, had to point out, you know, don't pick up a plate that's been eaten from and then handle other things which are meant for use in the deity worship. He got me 2 or 3 times on that. And various other things. And I realized that Prabhupada must have given the same instructions, you know, hundreds and maybe thousands of times over the period of, you know, 10 or 11 years. And he was still very patiently doing it again and again and again. Prabhupada had, you know, tremendous, I mean, he was the personification of utsahan, enthusiasm, and, you know, patience. When I first read the Nectar of Instruction, and it's mentioned there that you need enthusiasm and patience, I couldn't quite put the two together. I was thinking that there were opposites, right? Enthusiasm means you're very energetic, you run around, you're always doing stuff. And then patience means you sit and you wait, right? I couldn't figure out how the two fitted together. But then when I saw Srila Prabhupada, I saw that he was the perfect combination of all those qualities. You know, he was always enthusiastic. He never stopped preaching even for a second. And at the same time, you know, he would repeat the same things again and again and again for years on end to train people up. Tremendous enthusiasm and patience. That is required for preaching. Okay, so then not long after that, we had another prasadam distribution failure. This was at the Kumbh Mela. So from Hyderabad, we'd gone to Wardha for a couple of days. From there, we went to Bombay. We had 2 days at Mahabaleshwar, which we had to fly down to Pune and then drive up into the hill stations there. So we were there for 2 days. There's another Leela on Prasadam on that one. I'll come up in a minute. And then Prabhupada spent about 2 weeks in Bombay. And then on January the 10th, I think it was, 1977, then we set off by train to Allahabad. And there was a very big Kumbh Mela. Of course, the Kumbh Mela is every 12 years. There's Ardha Mela 6 years, and there's a regular Mela every year. So every 12 years, there's the big Mela, Kumbh Mela. And this was said to be the most auspicious Kumbh Mela in a cycle of 12 Kumbh Melas. So 12 times 12 means 144. So it was the most auspicious Mela for 144 years by astronomical calculation. So Prabhupada naturally wanted to do something big there. In 1971, just after he had brought ISKCON officially to India, he had the devotees go with him to Allahabad, and that was the Ardha Mela. And that was a little successful, but there weren't that many devotees that were available. Now in 1977, he was expecting to do something very big. And he had put Gurudas Swami at that time and Nandakumar Swami in charge of the arrangements and Bhagavat Das. So when we got to the Kumbh Mela, everything was a failure. They'd gotten this camp. They told Srila Prabhupada, we've got this nice camp. It's right next to the governor's camp. It's very prestigious. But then when we went there, we saw that the governor's camp was way, way over the side. There was a main area where they have all the big pandals and all the, you know, big Mayavadi gurus. They had huge setups. 10,000 people a night were sleeping in their camps. They were lecturing all day and night. They were feeding on a massive scale. You know, I mean, there were millions of people there. It's the Kumbh Mela. So where was our camp? Way over the side. You know, there in Allahabad, there's crossing the Ganga. There's this huge, very, very high viaduct. Yeah, the railway line. So we were just underneath the railway line, and the main area was way over, so nobody could find us. And our devotees, they set up this camp. They had a pandal set up, but nobody knew where we were. So Prabhupada didn't even speak. His intention was that if it was good, he would stay for 2 or 3 weeks. But after 4 or 5 days, he saw, you know, that it's a failure. Nobody was coming for the pandal. The first day that we were there, there was no electricity anyway. And so that was a failure. And then the other thing that Prabhupada wanted was massive prasadam distribution. So somehow or another, the devotees thought that when they go to Allahabad, they'll go out shopping every day and buy all the bhoga and bring it back in and cook. Of course, 5 million other people were also thinking the same thing. So there was nothing to buy. Yeah, all the other camps had brought, you know, tons of rice and dal and sabjis with them on the train. And they were all set up. We had nothing. So there was no prasadam distribution. So Prabhupada was so disturbed by that, he called the managers in on the day that we left, and he really chastised them, you know, for their bad management. The only thing he said that saved it was that Gopal Krishna Maharaj had, I think, On the Way to Krishna printed in Hindi. And it was just printed just before the mailer. He had the books delivered to the mailer. And so the devotees were able to go out, do Harinam, and sell Prabhupada's books in Hindi. So that kind of saved everything. And Prabhupada ordered them to stay at the mailer until all the books were distributed. So he left himself around about the 18th, or the 17th evening, 18th. And it was an interesting story, actually. When we were in Bombay, just in the last week of December of 76, they were trying to make the arrangements for getting to Allahabad. And again, poor management, no forethought. They had failed to book the seats on the train. So when the Kumbh Melas are on, then, you know, the trains, there's extra trains that are put on, and all the trains are booked up for about a year in advance. I mean, months, many, many months. It's very difficult to get any seats on the trains. So our devotees thought they were just going to go down to the railway station and book, you know, 40 or 50 seats on the train a week before the mailer. And of course there were no seats available. So then they were all in anxiety. How are we going to get to Allahabad? So just, I think, around Christmas time, this man, Mr. Gupta, he suddenly turned up at the temple. He was a very nice man. And it turned out that he was the second or third in command of the entire railway system for eastern India. And you know, he had come, he'd somehow or another have some problems in his family life, and he was in a lot of anxiety. He met the devotees, he came to Hare Krishna land, it was like an oasis for him, you know, just sitting and hearing the chanting, looking at the deities. He was so happy. So he was introduced to Srila Prabhupada. And then they found out that, you know, this man is in charge of the railway system. So, you know, he was so eager to serve. So he said, don't worry, I'll make the arrangements. So what he did was that there was a certain allocation of carriages for each district. And his district was already booked up. The next district occurred, the northern district occurred just before Allahabad. Yeah, there was like the border, and his jurisdiction ended just before the trains got into Allahabad. So in Allahabad, they had already booked extra carriages. So what he did was he just simply added on an extra carriage in his jurisdiction and bounced, you know, the carriage that was going to be added on in the next district. I mean, it was completely illegal, but he just, you know, did it for the devotees. So he added this, he just, you know, shunted in this extra carriage just for us. So we were able to get to the Kumbh Mela. Then when Prabhupada decided to leave early, Mr. Gupta had come to the Kumbh Mela to see how everything was going. So Prabhupada asked him, can you arrange for us to go to Calcutta? So, no problem, leave it to me. So he did the same thing. You know, all the carriages were, you know, booked up extra. And what he did was he had us, on the night we left, he had us drive out of Allahabad. So we didn't get on the train at Allahabad station. I think there's another station called Naini or something, which was a bit further down, a few miles further down. So he had us drive out to there. And that station was in his jurisdiction, not the Northern Railways. So we drove out to there. And then instead of going to the train station, he had us drive down the side of the railway tracks about a mile. So we're in the middle of nowhere. And I was thinking, what's going on here? But he said, don't worry, you know, everything's arranged. So we sat in the car. Prabhupada was in the car. There was a couple of dozen devotees that were coming with us. All the Mayapur devotees were coming back. Bhavananda Jayapataka, I think, was there. And after 10 or 15 minutes, we see a train coming, because it's night time. So this train's coming. And then as the train gets level with us, it stops. Right? And it pulls up, and he had added another extra carriage onto the train. Yeah? Well, and it's point of departure, and then he had the train pull up the extra carriage exactly where the car was, and then he had his men standing there. They had a set of wooden steps, and they ran up and they put the steps there, and then Prabhupada got out the car, straight up the steps and into the carriage, and then all the devotees jumped into the carriage. So it was it was very far out what he did, and Prabhupada really appreciated it. And he invited him to Mayapur. He said, you've treated me just like a father treats a son. He said, I'm very much appreciative like that. So it was very nice. So off we went. So we had an overnight train trip to Calcutta. So Prabhupada stayed up practically the whole night. Now, Rameshwara Swami had come on as Prabhupada's secretary just before we came to Allahabad. And he was, you know, very keen to get as much association with Prabhupada as possible. He was, you know, a man that was very well known for his enthusiasm. And so I kind of took rest during the night because I knew that in the morning I would have a lot of things to do when we arrived in Calcutta. And so I wanted to make sure I had enough rest. But I saw Rameshwara stayed up all night talking with Srila Prabhupada. And they talked about all kinds of stuff, you know, the state of the world. Rameshwara used to have these, you know, ideas about conquering the whole world and, you know, cultural conquests and this and that. And so as they talked, Prabhupada brought up the whole thing about the, you know, no prasadam distribution in Allahabad. He was very annoyed about it. And so he dictated a letter to Rameshwara on the train, which was to be sent to all ISKCON temple presidents. So, please accept my blessings. This is January the 18th. Now you must arrange, in each temple, there must be sufficient stock of prasadam for distribution. You can keep first-class cooks, two or three, and they should always be engaged. Whenever any guest comes, he must get prasadam. This arrangement must be made, that the cooks prepare 10 or 20 servings at a time of puris and sabjis, and you can add halava and pakoras, and the visitors must be supplied immediately. Whenever a gentleman comes, he must be served. As the 20 servings have been distributed, immediately the cooks prepare another 20 servings and store it. At the end of the day, if no one comes, our own men can take it, so there is no loss. You cannot say, it is finished, it is not cooked yet, or there is no supply for cooking. This must be enforced rigidly. The temple is being managed by Srimati Radharani, Lakshmiji. So why should there be want? Our philosophy is, if anyone comes, let him take prasadam, chant Hare Krishna, and be happy. Everything is being supplied by Krishna. Krishna is not poor, so why should we deny them? This should be done at any cost. There is no difficulty, it simply requires nice management. At the end of the day, you may sell or give away. If we believe that Krishna is providing and maintaining everyone, then why should we be misers? That means losing faith in Krishna and thinking that we are the doers and suppliers. We are confident that Krishna will supply. Let the whole world come, we can feed them. So please do this nicely and begin at once. Hoping this meets you in good health, your ever well wisher, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. So there you go. No excuses. Radharani is in charge of everything. She's Lakshmi. If you make the effort, she'll provide. Krishna will provide. And if you think, by material calculation, oh, if we cook so many meals, that will cost us so much money every day, we can't afford it. That's, as Prabhupada said, that means that you have no faith in Krishna. Krishna will supply. If you want to do something, if it's genuine and devotional, Krishna will supply. That means Krishna consciousness. So he was very clear about that. I don't know how many temples even know this letter exists anymore. But that's management. Yeah, that everybody that comes must get prasadam. And as we've seen, Prabhupada would become very disturbed if for some reason or another prasadam was not being distributed. So I have my own experience, another failure. when the last world tour in 76 had been figured out, I wrote to my parents. They were I'm originally from England, so they were living in the northern England, and I wrote to them that we're coming on such and such a day, you can come and see me. So I had not seen them since 1971. I had emigrated here to Australia with three school friends. And I had come here with the intention of never going back. I really, you know, didn't like England. I didn't like the cold and miserable weather, and just generally speaking, you know, although I was born and brought up there, I just didn't like the place. And in those days, you could come to Australia for £10. Yeah, the government had a £10 passage scheme. And if you were accepted, if you met the criteria, then they would pay your fare over from England. You could fly or you could go by boat. And you just paid a token £10. Then the deal was that if you stayed for 2 years, you were absolved of any obligation. They would immediately give you a residential permit. But if you left before 2 years were up, then you had to pay back the money that it costs to bring you out. Plus, of course, you had to pay your own way out again. So, you know, the moment that I arrived, I was in ecstasy because it was sunny. I felt like I'd been liberated. Just that, you know, every day it was sunny because it wasn't Melbourne that I arrived in. We went to Sydney. You know, just it was just so nice, and I loved it. So I stayed here, and of course, the second day that we arrived, they let us off the boat in Sydney. We moved into a hostel. They gave you 1 week, and you had that 1 week to find a job and get a place to live. You were on your own. So I think the hostel was at Dulwich Hill. And on the boat, we had met a few guys, some from Scotland, a few guys from London, and like that. So the first day out, you know, we moved in the hostel, we decided let's go downtown Sydney and see what's happening, see what it's like. So we, I guess we went by bus or train or something. We got into downtown Sydney, and as we're walking down, we stop at the lights, we hear this, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. We hear this music and singing, and what's that? And then the devotees, you know, we saw them, they were standing there, and I was immediately attracted to them. I'd never seen devotees before. I had no idea what they were doing or what they were about. But the one thing that struck me was that these people are here in the middle of this huge city. And I really didn't like Sydney. I got an instant dislike to the crowds. I was from a small town in northern England. I never lived in a big city before. And now we were in this huge city and I really felt, you know, boxed in. I didn't like it. But I saw that the devotees, although they were there, right in the middle of the city streets, they were somewhere else. You know, they just had this aura about them that they just weren't part of the, you know, city crowd. They were just somewhere else in the consciousness. So that attracted me. And I was already, you know, taking an interest in yoga. I had already, somehow or another, worked out that, you know, we reincarnate from one body to another. But, you know, I just hadn't quite made the connection with the devotees. So as we're standing at the lights, this woman walked up. She had a very strong Manchester accent, which I could relate to because that was just about, you know, just not so far from where I lived. And she offered me a BTG. So that was by Barbie, Charu's wife. I bought the Back to Godhead. I gave her 20 cents. She invited me to the love feast. Now, Prabhupada there mentioned about the love feast. Who was in Sydney at the weekend? Yeah, a couple. So, who was it? Gaur Kashyapa. Gaur Kashyapa was saying how he joined the movement. He was only a 14-year-old boy at that time. So he mentioned how he had been invited to the love feast and that he would have been completely baffled. What is a love feast? Right? I had the same experience. Yeah, Bhai Babi invited me to come to the love feast. And I was thinking, what the heck is a love feast? You know? And the only conception I had of a feast was from what I'd seen on the TV when I was growing up. And they used to have, you know, these dramas or films about medieval England, you know, Robin Hood and all that stuff. And, you know, the guy is sitting there on a big, huge table with dogs underneath and a hog's head on the top with an apple in its mouth and all, you know. That was my conception of a feast. And I was thinking, what is this? A love feast? You know. Anyway, somehow or another, We didn't go there. We decided we didn't like Sydney, and we wanted to go back to Perth, where we had, you know, had a half day on the way around. So I bought this magazine. It was a number 37. It had the Rasalila on the front. Very nice painting. And we were looking at it when we got back to the hostel. We're looking at it and trying to figure out what it is. And you know, it was very strange. We'd never seen anything like it at all. And this Scottish guy that we'd met on the boat, his name was Bill, he looked at it and he said, he said, I think those blue fellas, he said, I think they be spirits. So that was as far as we got, right? All the little Krishnas, right? Krishnas dancing with each gopi. So the blue fellas were spirits. I looked inside the magazine. It was completely foreign. I couldn't even read the English, what to speak about, you know, the Sanskrit and everything else. But somehow or another, I knew this magazine is very important. And it was almost like it was alive. It was vibrating practically. So I thought, I'll keep this and I'll read it when I'm ready for it. So I put it in my suitcase and I kept it with me. I spent 6 months up in the mining camps, because we had no money, so we got jobs in the northwest at Paraburdu, a place, a new mining town that was being set up there. And I spent 6 months there, and every now and again I'd take out the BTG and I'd read it. Because I was reading all kinds of other stuff as well, Lobsang Rampa and, you know, science fiction and anything that would make my brain speculate more. So I could, try to figure out what was going on, why we're here, what happens when you die. These were the questions. Finally, I got to the point at the end of the year, this was 71, where I just knew that I couldn't stay where I was anymore, and I had to go back to Sydney and find the devotees and find out, if they knew the answer to my questions. So I took off. I left my friends up in the north after Christmas, and in early January I came down via Melbourne to Sydney. When I arrived in Melbourne, by that time the devotees had actually started the first temple here in Melbourne. They'd come from Sydney and started something up. So I was on, about an 8-hour stopover. I had an evening train to go to Sydney. So I just thought I'll wander around Melbourne and have a look around the city. And of course, just around the corner from Flinders Station, there was the city square. And then I hear the same thing. Ching, 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 ching. Hare Krishna. And I was so happy. I saw the devotees there, and they're all, chanting, and there's a big crowd around. And I listened for a little while, and then I saw one brahmachari. He was holding a big stack of magazines. So I went up to him, and I asked him, I said, "Do you have anything there that tells you what God is?" So he practically, had a fit. He got very excited. I guess they didn't get too many people coming up and asking that kind of question. To his credit, he read out to me a paragraph from Prabhupada's article in one of the magazines. And it was a description of God. So he read it out to me. And so I put my finger in the page, and I kept that, and I bought, there were three magazines that he had that I didn't have, so I bought the three, and he was doing his best, to persuade me to come to the Melbourne Temple, which I have no idea where that was at that time, at some house they were renting, but somehow or another I had it fixed in my brain that I had to go to Sydney, that was the place. So I politely declined, and then I went off down to the riverbank to read these back to Godheads whilst I was waiting for the train. So then, I opened it up at this place where he quoted this paragraph, and there was a complete description. Now that was my last big question. I kind of figured out about reincarnation. I figured out the material world was an illusion, and it was, temporary, and that it was a limited space. But I didn't know what was beyond it, and I didn't know, what happened to you after you die. And the big question that was, coming more and more into my brain when I was up in the north was God. 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 I hated it, actually. I was an atheist when I was a teenager. And somehow or another, looking for answers to why we're here and what happens to you when you die, brought me back to this question about, what is God? And it was a three-letter word that gave me so much problem. I couldn't figure out anything about it. I figured everything else out, more or less. But I just couldn't figure out what God was. That was my last big question. So I read this description, and then Prabhupada saying that, God is omniscient. God is omnipresent. God is omnipotent, and God is a person, and his name is Krishna. So I read that, and as I read it, I read God is omniscient, and I just like a light bulb going off in my head, I got a flash on, what it meant to be omniscient. You're outside the universe looking in, and you know everything all at once, and it just flashed on me. And then God is omnipresent. And again, I got another flash. The same thing, that, you know, it's possible to be everywhere all at the same time. And then the third one, God is omnipotent. Yeah, that if you're everywhere and you know everything, then you must be in control of it all. And I got another flash. And then, God is a person. And then that was it. That was like about a million light bulbs going off in my head. And I thought, that's it, of course. He has to be a person. So that was it. That I was convinced. Then I decided on the spot that I was going to join the temple. I'd never been to one. I had no idea what they did, how they lived or anything. But the implication of it hit me very immediately, that if I accept that God actually exists, that He knows everything and He's everywhere and He's in control of everything, that means He knows everything about me, and there's nowhere where I can go where I can hide. Right? I can't pretend that He doesn't exist anymore, because He's watching me at every moment and He knows everything about me. And He's everywhere and He's fully in control. So where's the question of me doing anything? So then I understood immediately, I have to be His servant. So that was it. That was my decision. I knew I've got to join the temple. So then, but the last thing was, you know, when then Prabhupada said, and His name is Krishna. And I thought, wow, He's actually got a name like that. So that, you know, that was Prabhupada. No mental speculation, no nonsense, no maybe this, maybe that. Before just before I came to Melbourne, I'd stopped off in Perth for about 10 days with a friend. And I had been advised by some other guy that I met in the mining camps, a young guy, that there was this fantastic book that he'd read. Something, I think, The First and Last Freedom by Krishnamurti. And he said, oh, you know, he was raving about it and telling, you know, everybody's God, everybody's this, everybody's that, you know, you can be whatever you like to be, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, wow, okay, I'll get one and see. So when I got down to Perth, I bought this book, and the first thing that I wanted to know was, does he say anything about God? So I looked through the index, the table of contents, and there was a chapter, Is There a God? Something like that. It's a long time since I read that, but something like, what, is there a God? So I went straight to that chapter. And then his opening paragraphs were basically that people sometimes ask me if there's God. So I tell them, if you think there's a God, then there's a God. And if you don't think there's a God, then there's no God. And I thought, this is bunk. I thought, this is bogus. You know, either he exists or he doesn't exist, but he's got nothing to do with whether I believe it or not. Right? So I just threw the book out. That was it. You know, a week later, I'm in Melbourne. I buy this magazine, and then here's Prabhupada. You know, God is omnipresent. God is omnipotent. God is omniscient. God is a person, and his name is Krishna. That was it. That's what I wanted to hear. Prabhupada was so clear and so positive, you know. No beating around the bush, no mental speculation, nothing. Just very clear, factual information. So I was convinced. Anyway, to get back to the point, I drifted a bit here. I wrote to my parents. I joined the temple in Sydney, and my friends had come down from the north by that time in early February. So as soon as they got there, I immediately joined the temple. And Prabhupada came about 6 weeks later. I got initiated on April the 9th. Well, I was, you know, I'd been in the temple a long time when I got initiated, 6 weeks. right, Narataki? Some devotees had just joined the week before. Some people had joined a couple of days before. Prabhupada's policy was to get things going. He just initiated everybody that was in the temple. That was it. So I got initiated, and then one of my friends, he was my best friend at school, Chris Hall, he decided he'd had enough of Australia and he was going to go back to England. So he took some pictures. They took a picture of me the day that I shaved my head. It was St. Valentine's Day, actually. And he took that back to show my mum. So when he got back, my parents completely flipped out. All the money that I'd earned in the mines, I gave it all to the temple. And so, you know, they thought, you know, he's gone crazy. And he's joined this cult. They've taken all his money, you know, and we got to get him out. So they were writing and saying, we're going to get the police to come and rescue you and this and that. And I was writing back, look, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. Actually, the fact is that we're not these bodies and you're not really my parents. So there was a bit of conflict there for a while. And then finally we came to some agreement that, you know, I wrote and told them that, you know, if you ever write another word criticizing the devotees, you'll never hear from me again. Right? So you don't criticize the devotees and I won't preach to you. So that was the deal, right? I used to write, oh, the weather's nice, now I'm in Sydney, now I'm in Melbourne, you know, blah, blah, blah. But nothing about the philosophy. So they settled down. So, 1976, to get back to the story, we were now coming to London. And so I wrote and told my parents, I'm coming to London, I'm with Srila Prabhupada, I'm his personal servant, so you can come down, you know, to Bhaktivedanta Manor and see me. So this was, you know, the first time in 5 years that I was seeing them. And also, you know, they had never met the devotees before. They had no idea what Christian consciousness was, what kind of life we led or anything. So they came. Now, Prabhupada had been very sick when we first arrived. Then, after 2 or 3 days, it was Sunday, and even though he was still not fit, he wanted to go into London, to Bury Place, to see Radhalandanishwara. So he went there, we had a darshan of Radhalandanishwara, he gave a class, he had breakfast. Then he was invited to the home of one of the first Indian devotees to join in London, Shiradakshay Vishnu. He was a businessman, he became initiated, his wife was initiated, his sons were initiated. And they had a house in... it was on 108 Ellesmere Road. Somehow or another he found this house with the number 108 as its address and he bought it. And he transformed it into a temple. Because Prabhupada had told him, you just make your home into a temple. So he did, literally. And he invited Prabhupada to come and speak there. And when we went in, he had deities. The whole thing was set up with, you know, posters. It looked like an ISKCON temple. It was his home. And all the neighbors came. So Prabhupada stayed there. He had his massage. And then he had lunch. And then he was going to take rest for a while. And then have more meetings. So I got permission to return to Bhaktivedanta Manor so that I could meet my parents. So I arrived there just as they did. And we spent a couple of hours looking around. I showed them everything. They loved the manor. They were very impressed. You know, big stately home. George Harrison had given it. They actually, you know, they heard there was a group of devotees chanting on the lawn. They liked that. So everything was very nice. So then after about an hour, I was thinking, it's getting near 4 o'clock. And that was, you know, in Australia, that was like 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock was when we began the Sunday feast. So I somehow or another assumed that that's what they did in England. So at about 4 o'clock, I asked some of the devotees, can you get some prasadam for my parents? Because I knew Prabhupada was so insistent, everybody had to get prasadam. So they said, oh no, there's no prasadam. I said, what do you mean? It's a Sunday feast. They said, no, we serve at 12 o'clock. There's nothing left. So there was no prasadam. So anyway, I was really disappointed, and I knew Prabhupada was, you know, not going to be happy. But there was nothing I could do. So I managed to sell my mother and my brother a Bhagavad Gita. My brother's a big atheist. My mother is, you know, the opposite. But they, between them, they bought a Bhagavad Gita. And then it was time for them to leave. So I was seeing them off at the front gate just as they were leaving. the Rolls Royce came in the front gate with Srila Prabhupada in it from London. So I ran, you know, I followed the car in. I told them, just wait here, I'll be back. I ran around the other side of the temple. Prabhupada got out. He went up into his rooms. I could see he was very tired from the exertion. I really wanted to bring my parents to see him, but I didn't want to disturb Srila Prabhupada, and they had a 4-hour drive back to their home. So somehow or another, I didn't, you know, ask Srila Prabhupada if I could bring them up. So I told him, my parents are just leaving, I'm just seeing them off, I'll be back. So I saw them off, then I came back in the room. So then Prabhupada was sitting there relaxing. He said, so, how did it go? So I said, well, they were very happy. They saw that I'm very happy. And they like the devotees and everything. And then Prabhupada said, so, did they get prasad? So one thing that I didn't do, and Prabhupada hit it right on. I mean, he had a knack of doing that. The one thing that you did wrong, or the one thing that you didn't do, Prabhupada, that was the one thing that Prabhupada would immediately ask you. Yeah. So he asked me, so did they get prasadam? And I had to hang my head down and no Srila Prabhupada. Then? And the way that he said it, it was like, well, then what was the use of inviting them? They'd come all this way and you didn't even give them prasadam. So he was very disappointed. He didn't say anything, but he was very disappointed. So a year or so later, 78 I think, or 79, I was visiting again. And this time I invited my parents again. And this time I had Bala Gopal and a few of the other ladies cook up a big feast just for them. And then I sat them down and I stuffed them as full as they could get with some nice prasadam. So they loved that. But that was, you know, because of Prabhupada's, you know, disappointment that I had not fed them before. So I was feeling, this time I have to do it. Okay. So it's late, 9:10. We'll finish at this point. I think there's a program tonight, yeah? Where is it? Is it here or is it? It's in the temple. All right. So we'll continue on at 7:30 this evening. Any quick questions or comments? Mahatma Prabhu.
You want to tell us about how you become sannyas?
No. By accident. No, I'm not going to go over that one. We're talking about Prabhupada here. Not me. The only reason I brought my story up was because it's directly related to Prabhupada, that's all. Any other questions? Okay, we'll finish there. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.